On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about several bills that address sexual assault. Attorney General Josh Call was on our program last month, and he talked about how the Justice Department had addressed a backlog of testing on sexual assault kits. And he was hopeful at the time about new legislation that could help prevent a backlog from happening again.
It's really critical that we did this testing process. And the reason is that if somebody comes forward, reports a sexual assault and has this evidence collected, we want them to know that if they want that evidence to be submitted to the crime labs, that it's going to be, and that we are going to do what we can to get justice in cases involving sexual assault.
Are you a survivor of sexual assault or a victim's advocate? What do you think of Wisconsin's handling of sexual assault cases and evidence? What do you make of bills that would store untested rape kits for up to 10 years? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ian Henderson is an attorney and director of legal and system services for the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, which supports dozens of victim service providers across the state. Ian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, let's start out by looking at a bill announced earlier this month that would create a tracking system for rape kits or evidence collected for potential sexual assault cases. And this bill was put forth by Representatives Jeremy Thiesfeld and Chris Taylor, a Republican and a Democrat, respectively. Mm-hmm. Can you explain how such a system would be set up and used?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'll do my best to give you a sort of a general overview. So this legislation really follows on some of the work that's been done nationally by groups like the Joyful Heart Foundation, which is an End the Backlog project that has developed recommendations for states who are looking at reforming their processes and regarding tracking and storing and testing of sexual assault kits. As we heard at the beginning of the newscast. This is Wisconsin has had an issue with unsubmitted kits, and we put into practice testing for those kits. And this tracking system is one of the key components for reform regarding sexual assault kits. And it would basically establish a data bank which would allow healthcare professionals, law enforcement, prosecutors, the ability to update and track information regarding sexual assault kits throughout the criminal justice process. And I think really critically, allow a victim of sexual assault to anonymously track or receive updates regarding the location and status of their kit throughout the criminal justice process.
Explain this tracking system. How could the system help survivors of sexual assault get information about their cases or their evidence?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think information is power for survivors. And if you think about sexual assault as one of the most dehumanizing and at its root, right, is about taking power away from someone. And so anything we can do as a society and in this case as a criminal justice system to restore power and options and information to survivors, that's a real positive. And so this legislation would allow survivors to anonymously and at their choosing when and where to access that information. If you think about what happened with the 6,000 kits in Wisconsin and also elsewhere in the nation of kits that were sitting primarily in law enforcement agencies, this would allow survivors to be able to access information to find out where the kit is in the process, and then to, if they want, potentially ask questions about where the kit is and what's happening with it. So I think that information is really critical for survivors.
Do we know whether this type of tracking system would be expensive, or would it be cumbersome, burdensome for law enforcement to operate and keep up to date?
Well, I do note in the legislation there, there's funding attached to that. I think that's really important. Other states have enacted kit tracking systems. So just to name a few, Washington, Texas, and Michigan, to name a few, have enacted kit tracking systems. And I think, again, speaking to the reasons why it's so important, I think, that's a cost worth bearing for the state to be able to locate that information and find out where those kits are. It's not just for survivors, but for, those who are involved in the system. When we think about the problem of the unsubmitted kits, they were just, again, kind of sitting somewhere, and this allows people to access information, whether it be folks within the criminal justice system or, more importantly, survivors. And I think that's a key component to ensuring we don't have that problem again.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about legislation in the Capitol this year that would address sexual assault. Ian Henderson is our guide. He's an attorney with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Your questions, your thoughts, you have a line, 800-642-1234. Were you or someone you know affected by our state's backlog of untested rape kits? Are you a police officer or perhaps an attorney? What do you think of the potential changes to Wisconsin's handling of sexual assault cases and evidence? Are there positive changes that you see coming along in the pipeline? What do you think lawmakers should know? 800-642-1234. Ian, another bill that is backed by Attorney General Josh Call and introduced by a bipartisan group of lawmakers would codify how the state currently stores these untested sexual assault kits. How does the state currently store these kits, and what would this legislation do?
Yeah, so this legislation is SB 200, the way we see this legislation really benefiting Wisconsin is that it culminates, or is the culmination of a lot of work over the past now nearly 7 years by a multidisciplinary group of individuals that were convened originally back in 2012 by then Attorney General Van Hollen, called the Attorney General Sexual Assault Response Team. And that group developed protocols regarding the testing, storage, and payment for rape kits. And so the protocols that were developed really gave survivors clear options at the time that they presented at the hospital for a forensic exam regarding just having their medical care only, regarding the option to have the kit collected and to participate in the criminal justice system, and then also to have a kit collected but to have it stored at the crime lab for a period of up to 10 years and then have the ability to then contact law enforcement to make a report. So this legislation basically codifies that work and puts it in statute, which we think is really critical to ensure, along with, like we talked about with the tracking system, this legislation is another huge step in ensuring we don't have a problem with unsubmitted kits in the future. And I think additionally, this legislation provides survivors options regarding engaging with the criminal justice system.
Where,
including, as I mentioned, the ability to have a kit collected and later and stored at the crime lab.
Where is it in the process? It hasn't had a public hearing, I understand.
It has not yet. It was introduced back in April, and no, it has not been scheduled for hearing yet. It's something that we are certainly working with members in the legislature to advocate for this bill, these bills to have a hearing. We think it's important that they move forward and that, again, they represent a real important step in ensuring we don't have a problem with unsubmitted kits in the future.
And last week, Senator André Jacques introduced a bill of rights for survivors of sexual assault. What are your thoughts on these types of proposals?
Well, you know, that one really just came out, and we are looking at it carefully. We have not been able to sort of really dive deep into that to form a concrete position on that at this point. I think what I would say, though, is we welcome attention to the issue of not only sexual assault, but sexual assault kits. So I think the more folks are engaged on the issue, that's a positive. And we look forward to working with the legislature on really developing the most comprehensive reform to ensure we don't have this issue again in the future.
Looking at bills circulating at the Capitol that address issues related to sexual assault, Ian Henderson is with us from the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You as well, 800-642-1234. Are you a survivor of sexual assault or a victim's advocate? What do you think of our state's handling of sexual assault cases and evidence? Call in, email ideas, WPR.org. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this month, an assembly committee held a public hearing on a bill involving underage sexual activity. Cindy Komrowski from Johnson Creek testified on behalf of the bill. She shared her son's experience with being convicted of sexual assault against his girlfriend before the passage of Act 174, otherwise known as the Romeo and Juliet law.
In the eyes of the law, he is looked at and treated no differently for dating someone younger in high school and having consensual sex than a 50-year-old forcing himself on a child.
What do you think of this law addressing underage sexual activity? If a conviction occurred prior to the passage of the law, would you support the ability to petition the judge for retroactive relief? How do you feel about legislation that deals with sexual contact by law enforcement? Join in 800-642-1234. And Ian Henderson stays with us. He's an attorney and director of legal and system services for the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Ian, so let's look a little more closely on this so-called Romeo and Juliet cases where young adults are convicted of sexual contact with teenagers, some cases then required to register as sex offenders for life. Last year, the state lowered the penalty for some cases from a felony to a misdemeanor. What are lawmakers now considering in these cases?
Well, yeah, and I will be honest that the bill that had a hearing in the assembly, I think, a couple of weeks ago. Again, that's not something we have spent a lot of time focusing on. Our efforts have been focused on other legislation that kind of what we've talked about and focusing more on survivors. But obviously, this is legislation that impacts them as well, potentially. And I think just speaking very generally, you know, we would just want to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences with such legislation to ensure that offenders who should be not be released and due to the nature of the assault, whether it was through force or coercion, we're not sort of going the other direction and making sure that there's again appropriate consequences for offenders who do engage in sexual violence.
One bill that's already seen some action in the Capitol this year deals with sexual contact by law enforcement. What can you tell us about that legislation, that bill?
Yeah, so that Assembly Bill 171 had a hearing back in June, and that is legislation we are supporting. And that legislation basically would close an important loophole in Wisconsin law. So right now, there's no prohibition on law enforcement having either sexual contact or intercourse with a person who's in their custody. In other words, right, that in such a situation, the prosecution would need to prove that that sexual contact or intercourse was not consensual. In other areas of the law, right, we have prohibitions on sexual contact by correctional officers on those who are confined in Department of Corrections facilities. There's also prohibitions on probation agents from having sexual contact with those who they're supervising, where lack of consent is not an element of those crimes. So we think AB 171 and the Senate companion bill are really logical next steps to closing that loophole and ensuring that prosecutors and law enforcement, more importantly, right, aren't having sexual contact with people who they are either stopped or detained or in their custody because due to the imbalance of power. I think that's what's really critical about this legislation. You know, law enforcement officers have a lot of power in our society, which means they have the ability to influence the choices over the people who they detain. And we think that an individual who is in the custody or is detained by law enforcement may not feel comfortable saying no, or they may fear negative consequences for not agreeing to sexual contact. And either way, right, consent is not possible when someone feels they don't have a choice.
Have there been cases in Wisconsin where prosecutors were unable to prosecute officers for sexual contact with a person in their custody?
You know, it's a really good question. I'm not sure. I think what we have seen is nationally, there was a high-profile case out of New York where law enforcement officers sexually assaulted an 18-year-old who they had in their custody. And when that was reported by the survivor, law enforcement officers claimed that the sex was consensual. And so New York and other states have looked at their laws, and we're glad that Wisconsin is looking at that to ensure that we close that loophole and that we make it clear that consent is never possible in these situations.
And every so often, a prison guard in Wisconsin is charged with sexual contact with an inmate. Do these same laws, do they not apply to other law enforcement officers?
Well, yeah, I mean, as defined, no. Law enforcement officers would not fall under that, the definition of correctional officer. So which is why we need to pass this law, because they would not fall under that particular provision of second-degree sexual assault.
We're talking about legislation in the Capitol dealing with issues around sexual assault. Ian Henderson stays with us. He is with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Your questions, your thoughts on this, there's a line, 800-642-1234. How do you think lawmakers should be addressing sexual assault this year? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Ian, there's been this simmering debate across the country, around the world, because of scandals involving Catholic priests about extending the statute of limitations for child sexual assault cases. Has there been any traction, any push for that in Wisconsin among lawmakers?
Well, has there been traction? No, it's an issue that, you know, comes up periodically. Well, when I say periodically, I mean really it's come up every session. WCASA, and right now we are working with survivors and the National Association of Social Workers to lobby for what we're calling the Child Victims Act, which, as you just mentioned, right, is about civil statute of limitations reform. You know, when we look at the prevalence of child sexual abuse in our society, 1 in 10 children are going to be sexually abused before the age of 18. And in 93% of those cases, the survivor knows the perpetrator. And when we look at the impact on girls of color, 60% of black girls are sexually abused before the age of 18. So we think legislation, which again, it's like this, and other states have enacted similar legislation, the statute of limitation reform, that statute of limitations are particularly problematic for child sexual abuse survivors. You know, the data that I mentioned earlier about who the perpetrator is, and that it's in the vast majority of cases that someone's known to the victim, that oftentimes those will be family members or authority figures who may pressure survivors to remain silent. You know, so therefore, as an adult, it may take a survivor years before they're ready to disclose the abuse and seek justice. And by that time, the statute of limitations may have expired. Currently in Wisconsin, the statute civil statute of limitations in child sexual abuse cases is 35. And we think that legislation to remove completely the statute of limitations for civil cases for child sexual abuse makes sense in terms of a way to allow survivors to seek justice.
Let's bring in a call now. Steve joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, obviously, sexual assault is just a heinous crime, and it's just the impact it has on everyone is just incredible. And that's one of the reasons why we keep the victims' names quiet. We don't publicize who they are. My comment is men, who is mainly men, who are accused of it, have their name put all over the media before they're even convicted of something. Are there any laws being proposed to keep their name silent so their lives aren't ruined in the event that they are not guilty of the crime they're accused of?
Ian?
Yeah, I am not aware of any laws like that. I mean, I think when we think of how crime is reported, generally speaking, the offender's name is released in some of those situations and is talked about by the media. In that way, sexual assault isn't any different from any other crime. But I'm not aware of any legislation like that.
Ian, when you look at the bills now, the legislation that you're seeing here currently in the Senate and the Assembly, do you see any ones that have quite a bit of traction that you think will pass?
I think, you know, of the ones we've talked about, AB 171, that's the law enforcement bill that we talked about, has had a hearing and we're hopeful that we can get a hearing held in the Senate and move that forward. I do also hope with the rape kit legislation, both the tracking system and the legislation regarding putting in those clear parameters of when law enforcement has to send in the kit, and the crime lab storing that, and the forensic nurses sending it to law enforcement. Those I think that they received a lot of attention, and we're really hopeful that in the remaining time of this session that we can get hearings held and get them passed and signed. I think they're really common sense reforms and much needed reforms regarding sexual assault kits and giving survivors choices and clear information and expectations about what can happen to their kit.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us. I really appreciate it.
Ian Henderson is an attorney and director of legal and system services for the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, which supports dozens of victim service providers around the state. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee, who will talk about the legislation that would allow formerly incarcerated people to vote immediately after being released from prison. What do you think about this proposal? What questions do you have for the state senator? Join in 800-642-1234. News is coming up next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kend. An estimated 6 million formerly incarcerated people nationwide cannot vote, and it's an amount that experts say has the potential to change election outcomes in key states with strict felon voting laws. Here in Wisconsin, a group of Democratic state lawmakers reintroduced legislation this month that would lift voting restrictions on formerly incarcerated people and allow them to vote immediately upon release from prison. Do you think a former inmate should be able to vote when they're released? What voting legislation do you think state lawmakers should consider? What policy would improve voting where you live? Join in 800-642-1234. State Senator Lena Taylor represents District 4, which covers North Milwaukee, Glendale, Shorewood, and Wauwatosa. She is one of three lawmakers who introduced this bill and another one that aims to change how prisoners are counted for the purposes of drawing legislative maps. Senator Taylor, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
Well, let's look at this first bill here, giving immediate voting rights to former inmates. What would this legislation do?
It would basically change life for 65,000 Wisconsinites that presently do not have the right to vote. 60% of those people would regain their right to participate in selecting who runs their government, who's deciding what their taxes are going to be like, and so on and so forth. So we already restore the right for people to vote, but we don't do it until they're off probation or parole presently.
So basically, this person who is released from prison, regardless of whether they are remaining on parole, probation, or extended supervision, you're asking for them to have the right to vote.
Yes, they participate in society. We're asking them to participate in society. We're asking them to be, law-abiding citizens. We're supervising them. They're working. They're paying taxes. They, are doing all of those things. And we're saying, let's also restore their right to be able to vote, even if they're on probation and parole, because often people may stay on probation and parole if they can't even pay restitution off or, pay all of their court fees that they may have. And so they may have to stay on extended probation sometimes because they did not finish.
And explain for us how the current law operates with formerly incarcerated people and when it comes to voting.
So presently in Wisconsin, you do get the right to vote again, even if you are convicted of anything, whether it's a felony of any type. from a violent felony to a nonviolent felony. But you only get that right to vote again after you have fully completed probation or parole. So let's say that a person gets 20 years in prison, and they spend those 20 years in prison and they get out, but they also have 10 years of parole. They can be on parole, they can buy a house, they can pay property taxes so our children can go to school, they can pay taxes and pay into Social Security and do all of that, but they cannot vote on who their representative is and how their government is run, because during those 10 years that they would be on parole, they would not be able to vote.
There was this 2013 study out of UW-Milwaukee found Wisconsin had the highest incarceration rate in the U.S. for black men. How would this legislation perhaps change voting outcomes for certain populations?
Well, it would be huge. I mean, first of all, we count individuals who are in the prison so that they can be counted for money purposes. We count them during the census. We count them where the prisons are, not in the communities where they come from, so that we could do preventative work. So if individuals who are formerly incarcerated and on probation and parole, 65,000 people make up people who are incarcerated and people who are on probation or parole. 60% of those are individuals who are on probation or parole. Just imagine, that's a huge number. And one out of nine African Americans are affected by previously having a felony. And then more importantly, you know, we're almost the Big Ten. We're number 11 in the nation for disenfranchising African Americans from their voting rights. And so with that in place, this would hugely shift that number for us as a state. It would hugely allow African-American men, who we lead in the nation in incarceration of African-American men per capita, because, you know, we only make up, what, like 6% African-Americans of the population in Wisconsin, but we make up 40% nearly of the people who are disenfranchised in Wisconsin.
We're talking with State Senator Lena Taylor. She stays with us as we look at this legislation connected to our state's incarcerated population. Have you lost your right to vote in the past? What was that experience like? Are you currently incarcerated or have been in prison in the past? We want to hear from you about your experiences with voting in Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Nick is joining us from Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hello?
Hi, Nick. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
You know, I was just thinking, if these people are out paying taxes and they don't have the right to vote, that's essentially what this country was built upon. We separated, and, the great Boston Tea Party and all that good stuff was about no taxation without representation. So how is it that we have this right to have these people pay taxes, you know, on the work they're doing, income taxes, and they don't have the ability to be represented, to pick their officials that represents them?
Nick, thanks.
That is exactly it. You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what we're saying. We're saying if individuals, have to pay into the system, they should not receive taxation without representation.
State Senator, this legislation has been around the block for a while. It was introduced back in 2007. What's different now, and why hasn't it been able to get through by the lawmakers behind it?
Well, I think the truth of the matter is why it hasn't before is because, you know, people have often, you know, not wanted to do much for individuals who are formerly incarcerated. I mean, that's just the truth. However, I will say that bipartisan efforts across the nation have really moved us in a completely different kind of vein. In particular, in Florida, they just restored individuals' rights to vote who have been who have previously been incarcerated. All of the states pretty much around us have put something in place to allow individuals to have restoration of their rights once they're released. Iowa, it has to be done now via asking the governor, kind of like we do with pardons. But the point is that all of the Midwestern states around us pretty much have restored individuals' rights to vote. So I'm just saying that Wisconsinites deserve that same type of equity. You know, we should not let let individuals all around us give their felons the right to vote, not be put in a position of taxation without representation, and that we allow our citizens, you know, to be not involved in this process at all. This is, you know, not what we're saying we want. We say we want them to be engaged. There's nothing more important than being engaged in your democracy.
What about this other bill that looks at how prisoners are counted for the purpose of drawing legislative boundaries in Wisconsin?
Well, it's beyond the legislative boundaries. I just want to make sure that I'm very clear that it is also, it is really more than anything for the census count.
Okay.
So when the census count happens, we count individuals, and that has a direct effect on, you know, how many representatives area may have. It's a direct effect on how much money area gets from the federal government. And like, for example, it was $1,000, I think, last time. So over the course of 10 years, each person is worth $10,000, so to say, that comes to that community because of the census count. Well, the six top cities in Wisconsin that have the highest African-American population, five of them are where our prison or jails are. And so those individuals are counted for the purposes of dollars, although they don't use any services in that community, although those representatives tend not to come and talk to them at all in the prison or jails that they're in. Those individuals are used for the purposes of dollars for a community, representation for a community, but those individuals benefit not at all from the dollars that come. So this is saying count them in the communities that they've come from, because those are the communities that have been touched by whatever, quote unquote, sent them to prison. And prevention work could be done, or healing work from the trauma of what happened because of the crimes that were done in those areas.
Let's pause right there, talking about legislation that affects prison inmates here in Wisconsin. Democratic State Senator Lena Taylor, our guide on these bills. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more State Capitol Report here on the Ideas Network. This is State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about a couple pieces of legislation that affect our state's prison population. One bill would allow former inmates the right to vote after being released, and this bill has been around the Capitol for years now. Madison Democrat Joe Parisi served in the Assembly from 2005 to 2011, and he talked with WPR shortly after introducing legislation in 2007 that would give voting rights to former inmates who have served time.
If our goal is to get people who have served their time in prison reintegrated back into society and to become productive members of society, a policy like this simply makes no sense.
Are you currently incarcerated or have been in prison in the past? We want to hear from you about your experiences with voting. Do you have a felony on your record? Should prisoners be counted in the population from their home or from the location of that prison. 800-642-1234. State Senator Lena Taylor stays with us talking about this legislation. Let's take another call now. Rico joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Rico.
Hey, yeah. So, okay, so if I'm understanding this correctly, so basically, like, if I was from Milwaukee and I got locked up and sent to, like, Portage, okay, and they do the census, that's going to give my representation out to Portage. And so, like, that's going to stay for 10 years where they're going to have disproportionate representation, even though I have no say in what's happening to me. I mean, that just sounds crazy to me. I mean, that doesn't even make any sense, you know?
Senator Taylor, does Rico have it right?
Rico, hit it out the park, Rico. That's a home run. That's exactly what happened. And what happened, and it would be, if you got a 30-year sentence, that disenfranchisement for that entire community, both with dollars and with democracy, that's exactly what it would be, Rico.
Dang.
Rico, thanks for the call. Let's go to John now, joining us from Hartford. Hi, John. What are your thoughts here?
I would just like to address that taxation without representation issue. The colonists were citizens of the British Empire, but they had no representation, and that's what that whole issue was. Whereas, you know, the situation with undocumented people coming in and being taxed isn't really the same, because they're not citizens here. They're actually citizens someplace else. And, you know, whichever side of the fence you're on is, you know, to what their rights are. But I just wanted it to be stated that, you know, we can't use that as an argument that, you know, oh, taxation without representation.
John, John, thank you for bringing that to the table there. And Senator Taylor, John saying, you know, be careful about using that type of comparison.
But I think he's also, you know, saying something that I think is really important, which is this is kind of what the country was founded on. So, you know, one of the things I want to be clear is that individuals who are incarcerated are citizens. Individuals who are incarcerated are getting taxed, you know, their communities even, so to say, are being taxed without getting the dollars that go into their community for individuals who are from their community. So, for example, Senator Fitzgerald has several prisons in his district. So it also gives kind of like the citizens in his area a hyper right to vote, because they get to vote, but maybe let's say if half of his district are prisons and half is not, that means the half that gets the vote, they're getting their right to democracy. The other half are not, that are incarcerated. He doesn't even have to deal with those people. So this is a real issue. We're not saying let's give the right to vote to people who are incarcerated, but if they get out, they surely should be able to have that right. And being able to count them is a benefit to the legislators in those areas versus the communities that they come from.
So the districts in Wisconsin and across the nation will be redrawn after the 2020 census. Are you hoping that this so-called prison gerrymandering bill passes before then?
I'm definitely hoping that it would pass. I'm hoping that we will do right by the communities that have the trauma from where the crime happened, often where the victims are also, and or the victims are from also. And those dollars are needed in those communities in order to be able to help to address whatever the harm is that was done, instead of it being used by communities that really, for all intents and purposes, have no connection whatsoever to the inmate.
Some people think of voting as a privilege, and if you commit a heinous crime, losing that privilege is part of the punishment. What is your response to that?
Well, I think, first of all, those individuals are not very well informed, because in Wisconsin, we do give that right back to people. So my issue is, if when you're incarcerated, you do not have that right, that's the argument that person is speaking about. But once they are released, my point is that when they're released and they can pay taxes and they work and they, and we're saying we want them to be contributing, productive members of society, I'm saying if you can be taxed, you deserve to have representation. And with that comes voting in that democracy.
Ed from Minocqua couldn't stay with us, but he's wanting to know the portion of our electorate that actually votes, because if prisoners have the chance to vote, would they? Would they even change anything, Ed asks, considering not that many people come out for local and state elections?
Ed has brought up a very good point that we don't have 100% voting of those individuals that are eligible. But what I would say to Ed is that most of the individuals who are on probation and parole are very much engaged with the system. They've probably been touched by our whole, you know, government process more than many people. They also would have someone that is supervising them. So I actually believe that they would be engaged. And the last thing I'd say to Ed is that employers tell me that some of the most loyal employees they have are individuals who were previously incarcerated. So I personally believe that they may encourage the rest of us to do the right thing and to always go and vote, because I believe they would be extremely engaged.
Let's go to Mike now, joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you. Couple things. It's similar to the comment you made about Senator Fitzgerald. Doesn't this also have a likelihood that the folks that would get their right to vote back be more Democratic than Republican? And the second thing is the trend of counting more people in cities, since more people are moving to cities, doesn't that take away future voting capabilities of rural communities, which is a national trend, not just a local or state trend? And doesn't that kind of precipitate that? I'll take my
I'll go with your last question first. Is it taking voting away from rural areas? It's not. The rural areas still would have the right to vote. It would mean that they do not get a hyper-powerful vote because their community is counted based on people who can't participate. And they would not get the benefit of dollars that have nothing to do with the services and the things that are needed in their community, because those are the issues that happen not in their community. And then in regards to whether or not individuals would lean Democrat, I'm just going to be very honest with you. People in prison, just like in our community, are not all Democrats. and more importantly, people do not always vote based on party. People vote based on a number of different issues. And so I think that those things will still be true. And lastly, I'll say this. I think the issue of criminal justice reform is more of a bipartisan issue than ever before. Even Grover Norquist has been, you know, going around the nation encouraging people to be engaged in criminal justice reform. I think what we would do is, versus Democrat Republican, I think it would rise criminal justice reform to the top of the conversations across the board among Democrats and Republicans, because it really is about humanity. People do need to be punished for the crimes that they do, but it doesn't.
And State Senator, you're breaking up there. Thank you so much for joining us. Lena Taylor represents District 4, covering North Milwaukee, Glendale, Shorewood, and Wauwatosa. Just ahead, Governor Tony Evers pledged to make speedier service at the DMV a priority. We'll get an update on how the department is doing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.